So, good evening, everyone. We'll start by setting a motivation for being here this evening. So, in the past week, our community has been involved very intensively in a workshop on nonviolent communication, learning how to meet ourselves with compassion, looking at our inner conflicts, and really what struck me was how much courage it takes to just look at what's happening in our minds and receive that with empathy, much less begin to turn that empathy towards someone who's pushing our buttons. Right, that it takes a lot of practice, inner work, and time. And watching this whole process happening on the personal and just interpersonal levels, it struck me how much more of a challenge it must be to do this on the global level. I mean, as much as I wish I had a magic wand to wave, it's not likely that tomorrow North Korea, the US, and China are going to sit down and have a peaceful conversation. It's already a challenge for us interpersonally, much less at that kind of, with long-standing conflicts and grievances, it's not going to go away overnight. But if we don't learn to talk to ourselves and each other with kindness and compassion, then what are the other options? We'll just continue with our reactivity. And at the much broader level, we're faced with nuclear war, the potential end of the species, our own lower rebirth. So no matter how difficult it might seem to be, and I was thinking about this too, like it only seems to be difficult to cultivate compassion sometimes because we're not familiar with it. Or maybe we don't have facility with all the tools that are available. So just as with nonviolent communication, we practice with ourselves, with others, step by step, again and again and again, we can have confidence that that's taking us in the right direction. Yeah, moving us away from reactivity and destroying ourselves and each other. So we can really rejoice that we've met teachings that help us to move in that direction, that we have this opportunity to deepen our understanding and practice of them, and to keep in mind that broad goal, knowing that we're not doing this just to make ourselves feel good so that other people like us, but because we know it has a profound effect on all of society, and that it's essential for us to cultivate compassion for the survival of our species and for all sentient beings to continue to flourish. So we have some new people with us here this evening, so I wanted to give some background before we get into this evening's review so that we all just get located on the same page. So for almost 2 years now, we've been studying a text on the stages of the path to awakening, and it's written by a 15th century scholar and meditator named Ngawang Drogpa from a part of Tibet called Dagpo. And he came to be known as the Gomchen Ngawang Drogpa, which I believe Gomchen means great meditator. So the text that we've been studying is called the Gomchen Lamrim, right? The Stages of the Path to Awakening, written by the great meditator Ngawang Drogpa. So clearly from his deep realizations. And any text belonging to this genre of Stages of the Path to Awakening offers us practice instruction in stages, which comes to suit the dispositions and capacities of different beings. So right now we are in the advanced scope, right? We're looking at teachings for beings who want to go beyond just the goals of the initial scope, which are to have a good rebirth, right? Going beyond the middle scope, which is personal liberation, getting out of cyclic existence yourself. Now we're looking at beings who want to fulfill our potential by becoming fully awakened. Yep. Developing our minds to, fully realize all our good qualities and remove all negativities. And we're wanting to do this because it's the best way to benefit all sentient beings. So if that's what our interests are, if you're interested in becoming a Buddha, yeah, something that you've thought about, you've investigated, you think, maybe it's possible, then the most important thing we want to do is to generate bodhicitta, And this is a state of mind that has two aspects, right? One part is wanting to benefit all sentient beings. So we've gotten clear about that. And then the other piece is how, right? So we want to become fully awakened to benefit the sentient beings by leading them to the same state. Right? So there are two methods to generate bodhicitta. One is called the 7-point cause and effect instruction, and that's what we've been reviewing over the last few weeks. And today we're going to start reviewing the second method, which is called equalizing and exchanging ourselves and others. And what the Gomchen Lam Rim text itself actually says on the second method is very brief. Yeah, it comes in, it's like an extensive outline. So this is like 4B, 2B, 3.2A2, something like that, right? And there's a little title that says, "The Training Based on the Works of Shantideva." So Shantideva was an 8th century Indian sage who wrote this beautiful poem called Engaging in a Bodhisattva's Deeds. And it's in the 8th chapter that he spells out how to do this meditation. So I'll just read you the, well, it's two sentences in the Gomchen Lam Rim. Yeah. So it says, "Since self-centeredness is the source of all misery, and all excellence resides in cherishing others, cease being self-centered and neglecting others, and invert the orientation of the two attitudes. Apply entire devotion to others' welfare, even with your breathing." So it's a challenging task ahead. And I think even from this very brief two-sentence description, it's clear that this meditation is pushing up against all our usual ways of thinking. Maybe I speak just for myself, but usually I think putting others first is the source of all misery and all excellence resides in taking care of myself, right? So please leave me alone. In any case, so Venerable Trijun went into great detail on how to do the meditation from this book called Transforming Adversity into Joy and Courage. It's a very beautiful commentary by her teacher, Khenser Jampa Tekchok, on the poem The 37 Practices of Bodhisattvas. Yep, so good manual for Buddhahood. And before going into the review further, I personally wanted to take a bit of time to just reflect on the lineage of these teachings. For me anyway, thinking about how the teachings have come down to us always helps my mind to appreciate them. And I also like stories. That's part of it. Yeah. So this meditation method of equalizing and exchanging self and others comes to us from the Buddha through Manjushri and Nagarjuna and was passed down in an unbroken lineage to Shantideva. And it was Lama Atisha, the great Indian teacher, who brought these two methods of meditating on bodhicitta to Tibet in the 11th century. And so the Dharma had been dying out there because of a king who was opposed to Buddhism. And then the next king invited Lama Atisha to please come and help revive the Buddha Dharma. And Lama Atisha actually went on a 13-month journey with traders by boat to find the teacher who could teach him about bodhicitta. So that in itself I find incredible. It's not like he could search about this guy online, right? He had visions, of course, that he had confidence in. So he finds himself with these people, undertakes this treacherous journey to what we now call Indonesia, and has to look for this guy who's called Lama Serlingpa, and, you know, figure out if the 13 months was worth it. Yeah, so he even took a long time to assess the teacher. But he received these teachings, and after 12 years, he realized bodhicitta, which is a short time in this life. So after that, he already had those realizations, and he brought those teachings to Tibet with him, amongst many other things. And he taught the 7-point cause and effect instruction publicly, but he only gave the instructions on exchanging self and others to one disciple, his heart disciple, Dromtunpa, because he felt that his other disciples were not fit vessels for such instructions. And for a while, these teachings were completely secret, passed down from one master to one or two disciples. Until this Geshe, which is the Tibetan term for virtuous friend or someone who's very well learned in the Buddha Dharma, his name is Langri Tangpa, and he wrote a poem called The 8 Verses of Thought Transformation, which we chant after lunch. And because he wrote this poem and it was easy to remember and was widespread, people were able to learn and practice them. And one day, one of the scholars, his name is Geshe Chikawa, he heard two lines from these 8 verses. And from hearing the two lines, he immediately knew he had to find who had written them, which also I find remarkable. Sometimes we've heard these lines many times at lunch. It's like, I'm just trying to imagine what it was like for Geshe Chikawa to hear the two lines and be like, yes, this is it. I must find the teacher. You know, so of course he embarks on a journey too in Tibet to find Geshe Langri Tangpa, But by the time he went to where Geshe Langri Tangpa was, Langri Tangpa had already passed away. But thankfully, he managed to find his disciple, who is Geshe Sherawa. And he studied with him for 14 years and also realized bodhicitta. And what's nice is that Geshe Chekawa taught these instructions to many lepers who were able to cure themselves of leprosy by practicing exchanging self and others. And these instructions became known as the Dharma of Lepers. And Geshe Chekawa, thinking that it would be a great loss if the instructions were not written down or taught publicly, began to do that. So it's thanks to his great compassion that teachings became more widespread. And as we know, they were passed down from, you know, in the Tibetan tradition, down to Khenso Jampa Tekchok and Sakong Rinpoche and other teachers of Venerable Thubten Chodron, and Venerable Chodron taught them to us. So I don't know, just reflecting on that whole journey and all the effort that people had to put into even finding the teachings, much less learning them and practicing them, I feel always inspires my mind, and it makes me a bit less lazy maybe, or when it comes up against resistance or difficulty, to know, yeah, that's normal, we can keep going, just like these great masters. And at this point, I'm just curious what people think about why these teachings were kept secret. You know, why did Lama Atisha teach the 7-point cause and effect instruction publicly, but for this method, he specifically kept it secret? Do people have any thoughts or ideas on that?
Well, my guess is because it's really quite difficult to do. It's not easy. Mm-hmm. I think that's why.
Your mind needs to be prepared for that practice. Mm-hmm. So you need a strong refuge, for example, an understanding of karma, cause and effect, compassion, is preliminary. Also otherwise... think you could misunderstand the teachings, taking on the other sufferings if you have not enough wisdom for that either.
That's true. So it says that this meditation is for the sharper faculty disciples, presumably who have more wisdom. And I thought too, because towards the end, you really do have to have some understanding of emptiness, and it's quite easy to misunderstand or, you know, fall into thinking, yeah, nothing exists. So to guard against that, these teachings were kept secret so that you had to receive them from a qualified teacher. So I'm sorry you're not in that position. I'm just repeating things from books and other people. In any case, one thing too, it is very hard to do. It was interesting for me to like relook at the steps of nonviolent communication. I don't know where it is in this book, but there's a section, the first step is just giving empathy to people, and there's a long list of all the things we do that are not empathy. And I realized, wow, for all of those are situations where we're putting ourselves above others. Like, sympathy is not empathy, right? Someone's in distress and you're like, oh, poor you, I'm in such a better situation, poor you. Or you try and one-up them by saying, gosh, that sounds bad, but did you hear about what I went through? Right, so all those situations, like, that we reflexively step in, or we're like, let me now diagnose your problem and tell you that it's clearly your ex-boyfriend who's been causing you all that grief. So, you know, anytime we're not offering empathy, we've put ourselves above in some way, I think. And it's just so difficult to even try and put ourselves on level ground with the other person to just receive what they're saying. Now, for me personally, my hard piece is sometimes my judgment just jumps in, right? Like, are you saying that? You know, really? Yeah, so to get yourself out of the way, to completely receive and be on the same page as someone else is, difficult. And that's just the first step. So, given that this meditation is considered more difficult, I really just wanted to spend today reviewing all the preliminaries that we have to engage in to get our minds ready. And then the other people can deal with the actual steps in the coming weeks. Anyhow. And similar to the 7-point cause and effect instruction, the first step that we meditate on is equanimity. But there's a difference between the kind of equanimity meditation that we do before the 7-point cause and effect instruction and before this meditation, which is on equalizing and exchanging self and others. So instead of me telling you what the difference is, or what I think it is, I thought we could actually do the meditations, and then we'll pause in between for a bit of time for people to jot down maybe what the effect has been, and then we can have a discussion on what we observe in our own experience, the differences are on our mind. Okay. So we can settle into our meditation posture. And first we'll do the meditation on equanimity that comes before the 7-point cause and effect instruction. So start by bringing to mind in the space in front of you someone you consider a friend or a dear one, someone you have difficulty with, who, you know, just being in their presence, you might shrink away or feel fear, and a stranger. And with these three specific individuals all together in the space in front of you, ask yourself, why do I feel affection and attachment to my friend? And why do I have aversion towards the person I consider difficult? And why am I apathetic towards the stranger? Let's give ourselves a few minutes, just see what the mind comes up with in terms of reasons. And as you watch these different reasons pop up, let's try and look a bit deeper. On what basis does your mind consider someone to be good, bad, or neutral? Are there qualities coming from the side of the person? Or are we making judgments from my perspective? And now reflect on how these categories of friend, enemy, and stranger are actually not as fixed as we think they might be. You can think about how one person might be a difficult person in the morning to you, and then a friend in the afternoon, and then maybe a stranger the next day. Think of a specific example of this in your personal experience. And ask yourself, who is that friend or enemy or stranger? So from doing this meditation, even briefly, we can see that it's our mind, our personal judgments that are creating these categories of friend, enemy, and stranger, and putting people into them. And actually that blocks us from relating to each and every sentient being in an open-hearted way. And try and imagine what it might be like to stop discriminating these different groups of people based on your own opinions or wants or needs. How would they appear, and how would it feel in your own heart? So let yourself just rest in this feeling of open-hearted concern for all beings. Maybe let's just take a few minutes to maybe jot down some notes or thoughts for ourselves on the effects of doing this on our mind. Anything that came up for you in your experience, yeah, before we go on to the next type of meditation and see how it went. So now we'll shift to doing the second kind of meditation on equanimity. And this is the one that we would be doing to prepare the mind to equalize self and others. Yep. And here Venerable Chodron says that the method that Khenpsur Jampa Thekchok taught was primarily in terms of our attitude towards friends, enemies, and strangers as well, but she also taught on how we could extend the method to begin equalizing and exchanging ourselves and others. So I put in some of her points into the meditation also. So we can go through that, and then we'll do a compare-contrast kind of exercise. So again, we'll settle into our meditation posture. So here the first step is we start with looking at some reasons for equalizing ourselves and others from our own perspective, and why this is something that makes sense. So the first point we can contemplate is that all sentient beings have been kind to us in the past, present, and future. So just think about today, you know, the fact that you were able to drive up here, or that you woke up in a warm bed, you had food to eat. All that comes from the kindness of sentient beings, even if they didn't specifically do something for you. We are benefiting every single moment from others' efforts. So let's take a moment just to connect with that feeling of being surrounded and dependent on kindness. And the second point we want to think about here on why we want to have this equal attitude towards ourselves and others is that the harm that they have done to us is so much less than the amount of benefit that other beings have given to us. You know, if our mind starts to find fault or say, resist the idea that beings have been kind to us, we can just check up in our experience today. Have more beings been kind to us today, or have more harmed us today? And that's just one day. So look in your own experience to see, have others been kinder to you, or have they caused you more harm? And the third point to bring to mind is that we're all equal and that we're all going to die. So really, that doesn't make any sense to hold grudges against people. Doesn't make us or them happy. And there's no need to discriminate. So here with this first set of reasons, from our own viewpoint, another point Venerable Chodron brings up is that others have been more kind to us than the kind of kindness we have shown to ourselves. Now you can think about how often the kindness we show ourselves is self-indulgence or creates negative karma. Unlike the kindness we have received from all sentient beings. Now we can expand our minds to start looking at the viewpoint of others. And here we see that not only have they been kind to us, but as Venerable Semkhe was talking about this afternoon, that all beings just want to be happy and not to suffer. And like she said, we can make some specific examples of that. How we and others are exactly the same, wanting to be happy, not to suffer. And now imagine if 10 beggars came up to you, each with different in their appearance, all reaching out to you for help and support. Would it make any sense to discriminate between these 10? Or can we see that all these beggars are equal in their wish for happiness and to avoid suffering? And develop that sincere wish to benefit all of them equally. And we can also bring to mind before us 10 patients, they're all suffering from different kinds of ailments. Again, we want to discriminate between these 10. Or can we again connect with the sense that they're all equal in needing help, wanting to be free from suffering? So here we can come to the conclusion that we're really just the same as everyone else. Our happiness or our suffering is not more important than theirs. And now in the third phase, we expand our minds further and we try and see things from the point of view of the Buddha, a fully awakened one. So we try and imagine how the Buddha would look at the people we label friend, enemy, or stranger. Would the Buddha see them in the same way? Or would he look at all of them with the same open-hearted concern and love? And if the Buddha doesn't see them that way, then maybe they're not friend or enemy, a stranger from their own side. You know, there's not something coming from their side that's inherently a friend or an enemy or stranger. Here we can think about what the consequences might be if they were from their own side fixed that way. You know, they could never change. Our friends would always be our friends, enemies would always be our enemies, strangers would always remain strangers. Is that a realistic point of view? So from reflecting on this, we can see that just as there's no inherent friend, enemy, or stranger out there, we ourselves are also not inherently me, and there's no inherent you right, self and other are mutually dependent. We are not extra special in the Buddha's eyes. And when we see that this is just coming from our habit to label me versus you and relate to each other in that way, we can see clearly that our happiness or our suffering is not more important than that of other beings. Really, we are all the same in this. And maybe here we can also pause for a moment to see if you want to make any notes or impressions of what came up for you compared to the other meditation. Yeah, so I'm curious what came up for people, like in terms of differences in experience, what the effect was for you.
I have always struggled with that meditation. Mm-hmm. And at first it was because it took me a long time to figure this out, but I realized that the very same people were in all three, almost in all three categories, especially the friend and enemy. Mm-hmm. You know, that people wiggled in and out of those categories so much that it was confusing to me for a very long time. And even still, I can only speak about it in comparison because I find that the second method makes me understand why I would care. Mm. Why would I bother? Okay, so I see that it's all because they relate to me or don't relate to me or they're mean to me or whatever. Okay, so what? But when I start to think about, how equal we really are, how much other people deserve the same kind of happiness, have the same deep, deep, deep aspiration as I do, then somehow that makes us more even. Mm-hmm. And it makes everybody else more even than simply coming to the understanding that, oh, I'm the one who made up all these labels. I don't know why, but anyway, I find and then, of course, the meditating on the kindness of others and so forth softens my heart. Whereas, oddly enough, the first method, that is supposedly for the more emotional method, and that aspect, mm-hmm. in the equanimity part, doesn't have the same effect for me.
Yeah, I find that on the visceral level of experience, that's kind of similar. You've put it very well, but that with the first meditation, often I feel I'm still here. Like, here's me putting all these projections out there with some level of control. And usually with the second one, somewhere by the second phase, I often think, wow, maybe I'm a beggar too. Often that comes up for me. I guess I'm just one of the patients too. Like, all right. I mean, I don't know about benefiting them necessarily, but I often feel that way.
I think, yeah, there's one comment online. Venerable Namjo, thank you very much, so much for this meditation. Most helpful. To think what the Buddha would think, open-hearted to strangers, easier than to someone I don't like. She thinks she needs to do this. She needs to do this meditation every day to help keeping that feeling. And then there's one question. I have a hard time thinking we are relying on the kindness of others versus we rely on people completely completing the task they are paid for to make a living. How should I look at that differently?
Huh. Well, I guess so. That You know, Venerable often talks about that, but I have to say I personally have not had that resistance come up in my own mind like that. I guess it's a bit of a sense of entitlement there, right? Like, I've paid for it, so I deserve it. Or those people are paid for it, so it's not like they're being kind or nice, you know. But I think we can think about what if they did not do those things, right? If they decided not to participate in the economy, if they decided to just do whatever they wanted or to go out and harm other people as they wished. But maybe it speaks to the level that we take for granted, the running of everyday society and how much kindness it takes. Yeah. Yes, Venerable Yeshe wanted to comment on that.
Somebody said the same thing to me one time. They couldn't understand, you know, they just go to work because they have to go to work. So I turned to her and I said, so when you take care of your patients, you don't care? You go to work and you don't care? No, I do care about me. Well, the guy that works on the road, he cares about his job and he wants to do a good job so we can drive on the road and, you know, there's no holes or whatever, it's solid. So people care. People care about their jobs. Most of them, anyway. And we're all working towards that, to care.
Thanks, that's a great way. That's part of equalizing ourselves and others, right? Knowing that we all, as people, want to find meaning and purpose in what we do, whether it's filling a pothole or filling a prescription. And another piece that helps me too, maybe, I don't know if this will help this person, but I'd like to just pick one object and think of all the work it took to create that object. And it's hard not to start, you know, thinking about, they may not be working for me, but they're working out of kindness to support their family, people who picked the cotton, who processed the cotton, who made it to stuff the meditation cushion, who stitched it, who designed the meditation cushion. You know, just all the human effort that went into that. Even the idea of a meditation cushion comes from kindness, right? Someone's like, oh, you need something to sit on that supports your spine. Yeah, so even if they didn't do it for me specifically, I think, it helps the mind to rest in that. Gosh, I remember too when I was so distressed over a breakup. The one line that helped me read in a magazine that said was, just appreciate the kindness of the earth supporting you today. I was like, oh, I can do that. I didn't ask the earth to support me, but okay, that's one thing on my side, even though I'm not loved. Cry. It helped pull my mind out of that. So, you know, whatever it takes to turn that mind. The earth loves me. So yes, the cushion loves you. The chair loves you. Did other things come up for people on the different experiences of these meditations? Or
I like that first meditation a lot because it, I don't know, just early on it was quite impactful. I just realized I'm the one who's creating these designations, friend, enemy, and stranger. But I was trying to think about it in terms of why. And so I played around with it in terms of they're meeting my needs, and then they're not meeting my needs. And then I thought, well, what about the stranger, though? Because, you know, if I'm in a room and there's nobody in there, or there's a stranger in there, I don't know. It was hard to figure that out. But it still seemed like it could relate to that because they weren't impacting. And I didn't get too far. I was interested in Xiaoyan's take on that meditation. Do I have a connection? Some people I'm connected to and some I'm not. And I really thought about that in terms of, well, like she was saying, I'm connected to the friend, I'm not connected at all to a stranger, and maybe I have a bad connection or something. Or I don't know what. I'm just not connected, I guess, with the enemy. Or I don't know. I can't remember how she explained that. But in my mind, I was thinking right away, like, but you're defining that connection somehow, or you're creating that connection. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's causes. A connection just doesn't, like, it's not like a wire. You know, it's not like it doesn't inherently exist. There's causes, there's conditions. So how much of that is coming from my own mind?
Yeah, and just in response to that, recently I started to stop censoring myself. I mean, the way Xiaowen said, I don't buy this meditation because it seems to have a definite conclusion I'm supposed to come to, that I am at the center. So I decided to just let my mind popcorn the reasons. And sometimes they're really stupid, like, why is this person my friend? They look nice. I've heard my mind say things like that, right? Like, gosh, they're ugly. It's like, okay. But to see, wow, you know, those are the snap judgments the mind's making. To say, okay, friendly. No, ugly, not friendly. Whoa. And it helped it to sink in a bit more. So it might not be that the word I is at the center of it, but I could see more clearly that it's just the habitual mind making these judgments. Quite sad.
Oh, there are two comments online. Rather than worrying about what their motivation is, I try to think instead about how much I benefit from what others do. Mm. Another one is, I think that I habitually look at strangers as potential friends or enemies, and the judgment can come very quickly as I access them. It's like I'm looking to categorize them for my comfort. Whether it seems easier to feel compassion for a stranger than for someone who has been mean to me, it is my self-centeredness and ego getting in that way.
Right, and that response made me think too, a lot of it's also our karma, right? The kind of habits we've had to just think, okay, people with these qualities are safe or not safe, or, and I think this meditation gets us to challenge that, to see that even though, you know, that this is just coming from habit, and over time we can shift our minds to think differently. Yeah. So, any other comments on this?
One thing is that I've received a lot of kindness from strangers directly. People helping me when I was broke down on the road or when I was hitchhiking. Just strangers being kind in many situations and holding the door when you're coming in at the laundromat with your arms full, which I do for others too. And the other thing I was thinking is, I guess because I've done different ones of these meditations a bit. When I did the first one, my mind automatically went to the part about, well, I'm just judging them based on how I relate, how they relate to me. But actually, we're all the same in wanting to have happiness. And so I was already going into the other meditation, I guess, with it. So I wasn't seeing a lot of difference in them. They come to the same point for me.
I've often thought that that first meditation works better as a meditation for showing you the power of your mind.
Mm-hmm.
And yes, there is an element of equanimity in it in terms of, would everyone see this person as a friend? Mm-hmm. Would everyone see this person as a stranger or an enemy? And what would it take for that label to change? That's also a question that I've worked with. But the second meditation, even without going into emptiness, is much broader and it seems like less self-referenced, more broadly, more broad perspective about the equality of people or living beings. In His Holiness's book called Compassion, he just has this nice piece about unintended kindness. And it seems to hinge on the fact that we're dependent on others. I just want to read these two sentences. He says, to deepen your gratitude toward all people, it's helpful to reflect on the unintended kindness of those who provide goods and services without even knowing the names or faces of those whom they serve. All of us are dependent on people who have no special motivation to help us individually. Help me. I like his phrase, unintended kindness. That way, I don't have to make a judgment about it, whether it's intended for me or not. It's like there's lots of unintended kindness just because of the dependency that we have, as someone mentioned already.
Yeah, thank you.
The first meditation, I'm always struck by how short a time it is for the stranger category. It's almost a blip. Because immediately the person goes into the other two. in my experience, in my mind. So it's a very, very shockingly short time that someone's a stranger. And with the second meditation, it really struck me tonight that, you know, thinking about what a Buddha is capable of and what an ordinary person is capable of, it's just when you've got bias and prejudice running, it's a mind filled with confusion and pain. And how fantastic it will be to be free of that at some point.
So, yeah, I do experience that, you know, the first meditation being very more self-referential and then the second one coming to a broader mind. This time doing it, one piece of resistance that came up for me was, you know, where it said, the Buddha doesn't see you as special. What?
Yeah, it's true.
Right. Right. And it was good to see that self-centered mind. It was like the first time I ever heard the Dharma, and this nun said, you know, we're all flowers. We're all like flowers. We'll bloom and die. It's like, no, I'm a special flower. What are you talking about? Just another flower? Ah! So I think these are helpful for us to, wherever, you know, you feel the resistance comes up, that's where you get to see your self-centered thought coming up and you know what you need to work on. I'm special. So anyhow, I wanted to share a bit from Sakong Rinpoche's teaching on this second type of meditation. This appears on the Burzin archives. And it was before the text of the actual meditation, there's a little, you know, preface where it says, 2 months before he passed away, Senshap Sakong Rinpoche dictated this teaching to Dr. Alex Burzin, had him write it down word for word, and told him to preserve it as his most important teaching. And that's the 9-point meditation on equanimity and then subsequently the 5 decisions. So yes, we should do this meditation every day. Yeah. And in it, he distinguishes between how the first type of meditation is focused on equalizing afflictions that arise in relation to friends, enemies, and strangers. And it's actually a meditation in common with the hearers and solitary realizers. And the term he used was mere equanimity. So mere meaning that there's a second method that goes further. And mere also because this method doesn't involve bodhicitta directly. So it's something, you know, you're working to, I guess, yeah, to equalize the mind, to remove the afflictions that come up there. And he said the second type of meditation is focused on equalizing our wish to be of benefit in relation to all sentient beings. I guess presumably there's already some wish to attain Buddhahood or go beyond just working with our own afflictions, really to benefit all beings. Then how can we make sure that actually happens, that we don't, while generating compassion or bodhicitta, get stuck on one group, right? So here Sakong Rinpoche says, in the second type of meditation, this is equanimity with which we have no feelings of close or far in the thoughts or actions involved in our benefiting and helping all limited beings and eliminating their problems. And Kenzo Jumpa Tekchok in his book adds, here we're trying to see that sentient beings are equal in terms of wanting happiness and not wanting suffering. So I must be without any partiality in my beneficial intentions and actions towards them. So this is an attitude that's unique to the Great Vehicle. Let's see, we have a bit of time. And instead of jumping into the 5 decisions and rushing through them, right, because that's the next step after we cultivate equanimity, we actually reflect on these 5 decisions that come from the Lama Chöpa Puja, right? But before that, I wanted to share a little story from the Nonviolent Communication Workbook, which might be fun. And also it helped me to remind me of the importance of practicing equanimity. So here's Marshall Rosenberg, and he says, I'd like to illustrate how a young woman used empathy to bypass violence during her night shift at a drug detoxification center in Toronto. And this young woman told him the story at the second NVC workshop that she attended. So at 11 o'clock one night, a few weeks after her first NVC training, a man who had obviously been taking drugs walked in off the street and demanded a room. So the young woman who was working at this center started to explain to him that all the rooms had been filled for the night. She was about to hand the man the address of another detox center where he hurled her to the ground. The next thing I knew, he was sitting across my chest, holding a knife to my throat and shouting, "You bitch, don't lie to me. You do too have a room." She then proceeded to apply her training by listening for his feelings and needs. Then Marshall Rosenberg asked her, "You remembered to do that under those conditions?" He was very impressed. And she said, what choice did I have? Desperation sometimes makes good communicators of us all. And she said, you know, Marshall, the joke you told in the workshop really helped me. In fact, I think it saved my life. Then he asked her, what joke? And she said, remember when you said never to put your butt in the face of an angry person? I was all ready to start arguing with him. I was about to say, but I don't have a room, when I remembered your joke. And it really stayed with me because only the week before I was arguing with my mother and she said to me, I could kill you when you answer but to everything I say. So if my own mother was angry enough to kill me for using that word, what would this man have done? If I had said, but I don't have a room and he was screaming at me, I have no doubt he would have slit my throat. So instead, I took a deep breath and I said, it sounds like you're really angry and you want to be given a room. And he yelled back, I may be an addict, but by God, I deserve respect. I'm tired of nobody giving me respect. My parents don't give me respect. I'm going to get respect. So I just focused on his feelings and needs and said, are you fed up not getting the respect that you want? So Marshall asked her, how long did this go on? Oh, about another 35 minutes, she replied. That must have been terrifying, he said. And she said, no, not after the first couple of interchanges, because then something else that we learned here became apparent. When I concentrated on listening for his feelings and needs, I stopped seeing him as a monster. I could see, just as you had said, how people who seem like monsters are simply human beings, whose language and behavior sometimes keep us from seeing their humanness. So the more I was able to focus my attention on his feelings and needs, the more I saw him as a person full of despair, whose needs weren't being met. I became confident that if I held my attention there, I wouldn't be hurt. After he'd received the empathy he needed, he got off me, put the knife away, and I helped him find a room at another center. So delighted that she had learned to respond empathically in such an extreme situation, Marshall asked her curiously, what are you doing back here? It sounds like you've mastered NVC and you should be out teaching people what you've learned. And she said, now I need you to help me with a hard one. Marshall said, I'm almost afraid to ask, what could be harder than that? She said, now I need you to help me with my mother. And despite all the insight I got into that butt phenomenon, you know what happened? At supper the next evening when I told my mother what had happened, she said, you are going to cause your father and me to have a heart attack if you keep that job. You simply have to find different work. So guess what I said to her? But mother, it's my life. So I think this is a lived example of why it's helpful to have equanimity and why we have to keep practicing it again and again as the foundation of our sincere wish to benefit all beings, and that really sometimes the hardest ones to work with are the ones closest to us who push our buttons every day, all the time. I think we can just sit for a moment and digest. And again, we can connect with the Buddha above the crown of our head, who really rejoices that we spent our time together this evening, looking at what gets in the way of us having open-hearted concern for all beings, and knowing that we want to develop that as the foundation for becoming fully awakened to be of effortless benefit to all sentient beings. And we can imagine that sincere wish as a brilliant light at our hearts that we send out to all beings in this universe equally.